When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Section 3 of Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Volume 2, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, translated by Thomas Carlyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 5, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Chapter 14. Our friends had sought out other lodgings on the spur of the moment, and were by this means much dispersed. Wilhelm had conceived a liking for the garden house, where he had spent the night of the conflagration. He easily obtained the key and settled himself there. But Aurelia being greatly hampered in her new abode, he was obliged to retain little Felix with him. Mignon, indeed, would not part with the boy. He had placed the children in a neat chamber on the upper floor. He himself was in the lower parlour. The young ones were asleep at this time. Wilhelm could not sleep. Adjoining the lovely garden, which the full moon had just risen to illuminate, the black ruins of the fire were visible, and here and there a streak of vapour was still mounting from them. The air was soft, the night extremely beautiful. Felina, in issuing from the theatre, had jogged him with her elbow, and whispered something to him which he did not understand. He felt perplexed and out of humour. He knew not what he should expect or do. For a day or two Felina had avoided him. It was not till tonight that she had given him any second signal. Unhappily the doors, that he was not to bolt, were now consumed. The slippers had evaporated into smoke. How the girl would gain admission to the garden if her aim was such, he knew not. He wished she might not come, and yet he longed to have some explanation with her. But what lay heavier at his heart than this was the fate of the harper, whom, since the fire, no one had seen. Wilhelm was afraid that in clearing off the rubbish they would find him buried under it. Our friend had carefully concealed the suspicion which he entertained that it was the harper who had fired the house. The old man had been first seen as he rushed from the burning and smoking floor, and his desperation in the vault appeared a natural consequence of such a deed. Yet from the inquiry which the magistrates had instituted touching the affair, it seemed likely that the fire had not originated in the house where Wilhelm lived, but had accidentally been kindled in the third from that, and had crept along beneath the roofs before it burst into activity. Seated in a grove, our friend was meditating all these things when he heard a low footfall in a neighbouring walk. By the melancholy song which arose along with it, he recognized the harper. He caught the words of the song without difficulty. It turned on the consolations of a miserable man, conscious of being on the borders of insanity. Unhappily our friend forgot the whole of it except the last verse. "Wheresoe'er my steps may lead me, meekly at the door I'll stay. Pious hands will come to feed me, and I'll wander on my way. Each will feel a touch of gladness when my aged form appears. Each will shed a tear of sadness, though I reck not of his tears." So singing, he had reached the garden door, which led into an unfrequented street. Finding it bolted, he was making an attempt to climb the railing, when Wilhelm held him back and addressed some kindly words to him. The old man begged to have the door unlocked, declaring that he would and must escape. Wilhelm represented to him that he might indeed escape from the garden, but could not from the town, showing at the same time what suspicions he must needs incur by such a step. But it was in vain. The old man held by his opinion. Our friend, however, would not yield, and at last he brought him, half by force, into the garden house, in which he locked himself along with him. The two carried on a strange conversation, which, however, not to afflict our readers with repeating unconnected thoughts and dolorous emotions, we had rather pass in silence than detail at large. Chapter 15. Undetermined what to do with this unhappy man, who displayed such indubitable symptoms of madness, Wilhelm would have been in great perplexity had not Laertes come that very morning and delivered him from his uncertainty. Laertes, as usual, rambling everywhere about the town, had happened in some coffee-house to meet with a man who, a short time ago, had suffered under violent attacks of melancholy. This person, it appeared, had been entrusted to the care of some country clergyman, who made it his peculiar business to attend to people in such situations. In the present instance, as in many others, his treatment had succeeded. He was still in town, and the friends of the patient were showing him the greatest honour. Wilhelm hastened to find out this person. He disclosed the case to him and agreed with him about the terms. The harper was to be brought over to him under certain pretexts. The separation deeply pained our friend, so used was he to see the man beside him and to hear his spirited and touching strains. The hope of soon beholding him recovered served in some degree to moderate this feeling. The old man's harp had been destroyed in the burning of the house. They purchased him another and gave it him when he departed. Mignon's little wardrobe had in like manner been consumed. As Wilhelm was about providing her with new apparel, Aurelia proposed that now at last they should dress her as a girl. "No, no, not at all," cried Mignon, and insisted on it with such earnestness that they let her have her way. The company had not much leisure for reflection. The exhibitions followed close on one another. Wilhelm often mingled with the audience to ascertain their feelings, but he seldom heard a criticism of the kind he wished. More frequently the observations he listened to distressed or angered him. Thus, for instance, shortly after Hamlet had been acted for the first time, a youth was telling with considerable animation how happy he had been that evening in the playhouse. Wilhelm hearkened, and was scandalized to learn that his neighbour had, on that occasion, in contempt of those behind him, kept his hat on, stubbornly refusing to remove it till the play was done, to which heroical transaction he still looked back with great contentment. Another gentleman declared that Wilhelm played Laertes very well, but that the actor who had undertaken Hamlet did not seem too happy in his part. This permutation was not quite unnatural, for Wilhelm and Laertes did resemble one another, though in a very distant manner. A third critic warmly praised his acting, particularly in the scene with his mother. Only he regretted much that in this fiery moment a white strap had peered out from below the prince's waistcoat, whereby the illusion had been greatly marred. Meanwhile, in the interior of the company, a multitude of alterations were occurring. Filina, since the evening subsequent to that of the fire, had never given our friend the smallest sign of closer intimacy. She had, as it seemed on purpose, hired a remote lodging. She associated with Elmira and came seldomer to Serlo, an arrangement very gratifying to Aurelia. Serlo continued still to like her, and often visited her quarters, particularly when he hoped to find Elmira there. One evening he took Wilhelm with him. At their entrance both of them were much surprised to see Filina in the inner room, sitting in close contact with a young officer. He wore a red uniform with white pantaloons, but his face being turned away they could not see it. Filina came into the outer room to meet her visitors, and shut the door behind her. "You surprise me in the middle of a very strange adventure," cried she. "It does not appear so strange," said Serlo, "but let us see this handsome, young, enviable gallant. You have us in such training that we dare not show any jealousy, however it may be." "I must leave you to suspicion for a time," replied Filina in a jesting tone. "Yet I can assure you the gallant is a lady of my friends who wishes to remain a few days undiscovered. You shall know her history in due season. Nay, perhaps you shall even behold the beautiful spinster in person. And then most probably I shall have need of all my prudence and discretion, for it seems too likely that your new acquaintance will drive your old friend out of favour." Wilhelm stood as if transformed to stone. At the first glance the red uniform had reminded him of Mariana. The figure, too, was hers. The fair hair was hers. Only the present individual seemed to be a little taller. "For heaven's sake," cried he, "let us know something more about your friend. Let us see this lady in disguise. We are now partakers of your secret. We will promise, we will swear. Only let us see the lady." "What a fire he is in," cried Filina. "But be cool, be calm, for today there will nothing come of it." "Let us only know her name," cried Wilhelm. "It were a fine secret then," replied Filina. "At least her first name." "If you can guess it, be it so. Three guesses I will give you. Not a fourth. You might lead me through the whole calendar." "Well," said Wilhelm, "Cecilia, then." "None of your Cecilias." "Henrietta." Not at all. Have a care, I pray you. Guess better, or your curiosity will have to sleep unsatisfied. Wilhelm paused and shivered. He tried to speak, but the sound died away within him. Mariana, stammered he at last. Mariana? Bravo, cried Filina. Hit to a hair's breadth, said she, whirling round upon her heel, as she was wont on such occasions. Wilhelm could not utter a word, and Serlo, not observing his emotion, urged Filina more and more to let them in. Conceive the astonishment of both when Wilhelm, suddenly and vehemently interrupting their raillery, threw himself at Filina's feet and, with an air and tone of the deepest passion, begged and conjured her. "Let me see the stranger," cried he. "She is mine. She is my Mariana. She for whom I have longed all the days of my life. She who is still more to me than all the women in this world. Go in to her at least and tell her that I am here, that the man is here who linked her to his earliest love and all the happiness of his youth. Say that he will justify himself, though he left her so unkindly. He will pray for pardon of her, and will grant her pardon, whatsoever she may have done to him. He will even make no pretensions further, if he may but see her, if he may but see that she is living and in happiness." Filina shook her head and said, "Speak low, do not betray us. If the lady is indeed your friend, her feelings must be spared, for she does not in the least suspect that you are here. Quite a different sort of business brings her hither, and you know well enough one had rather see a spectre than a former lover at an inconvenient time. I will ask her and prepare her. We will then consider what is further to be done. Tomorrow I shall write you a note saying when you are to come, or whether you may come at all. Obey me punctually, for I protest that without her own and my consent, no eye shall see this lovely creature. I shall keep my doors better bolted, and with axe and crow you surely will not visit me." Our friend conjured her, Serlo begged of her, but all in vain. They were obliged to yield and leave the chamber and the house. With what feelings Wilhelm passed the night is easy to conceive. How slowly the hours of the day flowed on while he sat expecting a message from Filina may also be imagined. Unhappily he had to play that evening. Such mental pain he had never endured. The moment his part was done he hastened to Filina's house without inquiring whether he had got her leave or not. He found her doors bolted, and the people of the house informed him that Mademoiselle had set out early in the morning in company with a young officer, that she had talked about returning shortly, but they had not believed her, she having paid her debts and taken everything along with her. This intelligence drove Wilhelm almost frantic. He hastened to Laertes that he might take measures for pursuing her, and cost what it would, for attaining certainty regarding her attendant. Laertes, however, represented to him the imprudence of such passion and credulity. "I dare wager, after all," said he, "that it is no one else but Friedrich. The boy is of a high family, I know. He is madly in love with Filina. It is likely he has cozened from his friends a fresh supply of money, so that he can once more live with her in peace for a while." These considerations, though they did not quite convince our friend, sufficed to make him waver. Laertes showed him how improbable the story was with which Filina had amused them, reminded him how well the stranger's hair and figure answered Friedrich, that with the start of him by 12 hours they could not easily be overtaken, and, what was more than all, that Serlo could not do without him at the theatre. By so many reasons Wilhelm was at last persuaded to postpone the execution of his project. That night Laertes got an active man, to whom they gave the charge of following the runaways. It was a steady person who had often officiated as courier and guide to travelling parties, and was at present without employment. They gave him money, they informed him of the whole affair, instructing him to seek and overtake the fugitives, to keep them in his eye, and instantly to send intelligence to Wilhelm where and how he found them. That very hour he mounted horse, pursuing this ambiguous pair, by which exertions Wilhelm was in some degree at least composed. Chapter 16. The departure of Filina did not make a deep sensation, either in the theatre or in the public. She never was earnest with anything. The women universally detested her. The men rather wished to see herself too than on the boards. Thus her fine, and for the stage even happy, talents were of no avail to her. The other members of the company took greater labour on them to supply her place. The Frau Melina, in particular, was much distinguished by her diligence and zeal. She noted down as formerly the principles of Wilhelm. She guided herself according to his theory and his example. There was of late a something in her nature that rendered her more interesting. She soon acquired an accurate mode of acting. she attained the natural tone of conversation altogether, that of keen emotion she attained in some degree. She contrived, moreover, to adapt herself to Serlo's humours. She took pains in singing for his pleasure, and succeeded in that matter moderately well. By the accession of some other players, the company was rendered more complete, and while Wilhelm and Serlo were busied each in his degree, the former insisting on the general tone and spirit of the whole, the latter faithfully elaborating the separate passages, a laudable ardour likewise inspired the actors, and the public took a lively interest in their concerns. "We are on the right path," said Serlo once. "If we can continue thus, the public, too, will soon be on it. Men are easily astonished and misled by wild and barbarous exhibitions. Yet lay before them anything rational and polished, in an interesting manner, and doubt not they will catch at it." What forms the chief defect of our German theatre, what prevents both actor and spectator from obtaining proper views, is the vague and variegated nature of the objects it contains. You nowhere find a barrier on which to prop your judgment. In my opinion, it is far from an advantage to us that we have expanded our stage into, as it were, a boundless arena for the whole of nature. Yet neither manager nor actor need attempt contracting it, until the taste of the nation shall itself mark out the proper circle. Every good society submits to certain conditions and restrictions. So also must every good theatre. Certain manners, certain modes of speech, certain objects, and fashions of proceeding must altogether be excluded. You do not grow poorer by limiting your household expenditure. On these points our friends were more or less accordant or at variance. The majority, with Wilhelm at their head, were for the English theatre, Serlo and a few others for the French. It was also settled that in vacant hours, of which unhappily an actor has too many, they should in company peruse the finest plays in both these languages, examining what parts of them seemed best and worthiest of imitation. They accordingly commenced with some French pieces. On these occasions, it was soon observed, Aurelia went away whenever they began to read. At first they supposed she had been sick. Wilhelm once questioned her about it. "I would not assist at such a reading," said she, "for how could I hear and judge when my heart was torn in pieces? I hate the French language from the bottom of my soul." "How can you be hostile to a language," cried our friend, "to which we Germans are indebted for the greater part of our accomplishments, to which we must become indebted still more if our natural qualities are ever to assume their proper form?" "It is no prejudice," replied Aurelia. "A painful impression, a hated recollection of my faithless friend, has robbed me of all enjoyment in that beautiful and cultivated tongue. How I hate it now with my whole strength and heart. During the period of our kindliest connection, he wrote in German. And what genuine, powerful, cordial German! It was not till he wanted to get quit of me that he began seriously to write in French. I marked, I felt what he meant. What he would have blushed to utter in his mother tongue, he could by this means write with a quiet conscience. It is the language of reservations, equivocations, and lies. It is a perfidious language. Heaven be praised. I cannot find another word to express this perfide of theirs in all its compass. Our poor Troilos, the faithless of English, are innocent as babes beside it. Perfide means faithless with pleasure, with insolence and malice. How enviable is the culture of a nation that can figure out so many shades of meaning by a single word! French is exactly the language of the world, worthy to become the universal language, that all may have it in their power to cheat and cozen and betray each other. His French letters were always smooth and pleasant while you read them. If you chose to believe it, they sounded warmly, even passionately. But if you examined narrowly, they were but phrases, accursed phrases. He has spoiled my feeling to the whole language, to French literature, even to the beautiful, delicious expressions of noble souls which may be found in it. I shudder when a French word is spoken in my hearing. In such terms she could for hours continue to give utterance to her chagrin, interrupting or disturbing every other kind of conversation. Sooner or later Serlo used to put an end to such peevish lamentations by some bitter sally, but by this means commonly the talk for the evening was destroyed. In all provinces of life it is unhappily the case that whatever is to be accomplished by a number of cooperating men and circumstances cannot long continue perfect. Of an acting company as well as of a kingdom, of a circle of friends as well as of an army, you may commonly select the moment when it may be said that all was standing on the highest pinnacle of harmony, perfection, contentment, and activity. But alterations will ere long occur. The individuals that compose the body often change. New members are added. The persons are no longer suited to the circumstances, or the circumstances to the persons, What was formerly united quickly falls asunder. Thus it was with Serlo's company. For a time you might have called it as complete as any German company could ever boast of being. Most of the actors were occupying their proper places. All had enough to do, and all did it willingly. Their private personal condition was not bad, and each appeared to promise great things in his art, for each commenced with animation and alacrity. But it soon became apparent that a part of them were mere automatons, who could not reach beyond what was attainable without the aid of feeling. Nor was it long till grudgings and envyings arose among them, such as commonly obstruct every good arrangement, and easily distort and tear in pieces everything that reasonable and thinking men would wish to keep united. The departure of Filina was not quite so insignificant as it had first appeared. She had always skilfully contrived to entertain the manager, and keep the others in good humour. She had endured Aurelia's violence with amazing patience, and her dearest task had been to flatter Wilhelm. Thus she was, in some respects, a bond of union for the whole. The loss of her was quickly felt. Serlo could not live without some little passion of the love sort. Elmira was of late grown up, we might almost say grown beautiful. For some time she had been attracting his attention, and Filina, with her usual dexterity, had favoured this attachment so soon as she observed it. "We should train ourselves in time," she would say, "to the business of procuress. Nothing else remains for us when we are old." Serlo and Elmira had by this means so approximated to each other that, shortly after the departure of Filina, both were of a mind, and their small romance was rendered doubly interesting as they had to hide it sedulously from the father, old Boisterous not understanding jokes of that description. Elmira's sister had been admitted to the secret, and Serlo was, in consequence, obliged to overlook a multitude of things in both of them. One of their worst habits was an excessive love of junketing, nay, if you will, an intolerable gluttony. In this respect they altogether differed from Filina, to whom it gave a new tint of loveliness, that she seemed, as it were, to live on air, eating very little, and for drink merely skimming off with all imaginable grace the foam from a glass of champagne. Now, however, Serlo, if he meant to please his doxies, was obliged to join breakfast with dinner, and with this, by a substantial bever, to connect the supper. But amid gormandizing, Serlo entertained another plan, which he longed to have fulfilled. He imagined that he saw a kind of attachment between Wilhelm and Aurelia, and he anxiously wished that it might assume a serious shape. He hoped to cast the whole mechanical department of his theatrical economy on Wilhelm's shoulders, to find in him, as in the former brother, a faithful and industrious tool. Already he had, by degrees, shifted over to him most of the cares of management. Aurelia kept a strong box, and Serlo once more lived as he had done of old, entirely according to his humour. Yet there was a circumstance which vexed him in secret, as it did his sister likewise. The world has a particular way of acting toward public persons of acknowledged merit. It gradually begins to be indifferent to them, and to favour talents which are new, though far inferior. It makes excessive requisitions of the former, and accepts of anything with approbation from the latter. Serlo and Aurelia had opportunity enough to meditate on this peculiarity. The strangers, especially the young and handsome ones, had drawn the whole attention and applause upon themselves, and Serlo and his sister, in spite of the most zealous efforts, had in general to make their exits without the welcomed sound of clapping hands. It is true some special causes were at work on this occasion. Aurelia's pride was palpable, and her contempt for the public was known to many. Serlo, indeed, flattered every individual, but his cutting jibes against the whole were often circulated and repeated. The new members, again, were not only strangers, unknown, and wanting help, but some of them were likewise young and amiable. Thus all of them found patrons. Ere long, too, there arose internal discontents, and many bickerings among the actors. Scarcely had they noticed that our friend was acting as director, when most of them began to grow the more remiss, the more he strove to introduce a better order, greater accuracy, and chiefly to insist that everything mechanical should be performed in the most strict and regular manner. Thus, by and by, the whole concern, which actually for a time had nearly looked ideal, grew as vulgar in its attributes as any mere itinerating theatre. And unhappily, just as Wilhelm, by his labour, diligence, and vigorous efforts, had made himself acquainted with the requisitions of the art, and trained completely both his person and his habits to comply with them, he began to feel, in melancholy hours, that this craft deserved the necessary outlay of time and talents less than any other. The task was burdensome, the recompense was small. You would rather have engaged with any occupation in which, when the period of exertion is past, one can enjoy repose of mind, than with this, wherein, after undergoing much mechanical drudgery, the aim of one's activity cannot still be attained but by the strongest effort of thought and emotion. Besides, he had to listen to Aurelia's complaints about her brother's wastefulness. He had to misconceive the winks and nods of Serlo, trying from afar to lead him to a marriage with Aurelia. He had withal to hide his own secret sorrow, which pressed heavy on his heart, because of that ambiguous officer whom he had sent in quest of. The messenger returned not, sent no tidings, and Wilhelm feared that his Mariana was lost to him a second time. About this period there occurred a public mourning, which obliged our friends to shut their theatre for several weeks. Wilhelm seized this opportunity to pay a visit to the clergyman with whom the harper had been placed to board. He found him in a pleasant district, and the first thing that he noticed in the parsonage was the old man teaching a boy to play upon his instrument. The harper showed great joy at sight of Wilhelm. He rose, held out his hand, and said, "You see, I am still good for something in the world. Permit me to continue, for my hours are all distributed and full of business." The clergyman saluted Wilhelm very kindly, and told him that the harper promised well, already giving hopes of a complete recovery. Their conversation naturally turned upon the various modes of treating the insane. "Except physical derangements," observed the clergyman, "which often place insuperable difficulties in the way, and in regard to which I follow the prescriptions of a wise physician, the means of curing madness seem to me extremely simple. They are the very means by which you hinder sane persons from becoming mad. Awaken their activity, accustom them to order, bring them to perceive that they hold their being and their fate in common with many millions, that extraordinary talents, the highest happiness, the deepest misery, are but slight variations from the general lot. In this way no insanity will enter, or if it has entered, will gradually disappear. I have portioned out the old man's hours. He gives lessons to some children on the harp. He works in the garden. He is already much more cheerful. He wishes to enjoy the cabbages he plants. My son, to whom in case of death he has bequeathed his harp, he is ardent to instruct, that the boy may be able to make use of his inheritance. I have said but little to him, as a clergyman, about his wild, mysterious scruples. But a busy life brings on so many incidents that ere long he must feel how true it is that doubt of any kind can be removed by nothing but activity. I go softly to work, yet if I could get his beard and hood removed, I should reckon it a weighty point. For nothing more exposes us to madness than distinguishing ourselves from others, and nothing more contributes to maintain our common sense than living in the universal way with multitudes of men. Alas, how much there is in education, in our social institutions, to prepare us and our children for insanity!" Wilhelm stayed some days with this intelligent divine, heard from him many curious narratives, not of the insane alone, but of persons such as commonly are reckoned wise and rational, though they may have peculiarities which border on insanity. The conversation became doubly animated on the entrance of the doctor, with whom it was a custom to pay frequent visits to his friend the clergyman, and to assist him in his labours of humanity. The physician was an oldish man, who, though in weak health, had spent many years in the practice of the noblest virtues. He was a strong advocate for country life, being himself scarcely able to exist except in the open air. Withal, he was extremely active and companionable. For several years he had shown a special inclination to make friends with all the country clergymen within his reach. Such of these as were employed in any useful occupation he strove by every means to help. Into others who were still unsettled in their aims, he endeavoured to infuse a taste for some profitable species of exertion. Being at the same time in connection with a multitude of noblemen, magistrates, judges, he had in the space of 20 years, in secret, accomplished much towards the advancement of many branches of husbandry. He had done his best to put in motion every project that seemed capable of benefiting agriculture, animals, or men, and had thus forwarded improvement in its truest sense. "For man," he used to say, "there is but one misfortune. When some idea lays hold of him, which exerts no influence upon active life, or still more, which withdraws him from it. At the present time," continued he on this occasion, "I have a case before me. It concerns a rich and noble couple, and hitherto has baffled all my skill. The affair belongs in part to your department, worthy pastor, and your friend here will forbear to mention it again. In the absence of a certain nobleman, some persons of the house, in a frolic not entirely commendable, disguised a young man in the master's clothes. The lady was to be imposed upon by this deception, and although it was described to me as nothing but a joke, I am much afraid the purpose of it was to lead this noble and most amiable lady from the path of honour. Her husband, however, unexpectedly returns, enters his chamber, thinks he sees his spirit, and from that time falls into a melancholy temper, firmly believing that his death is near. He has now abandoned himself to men who pamper him with religious ideas, and I see not how he is to be prevented from going among the Herrnhuters with his lady, and, as he has no children, from depriving his relations of the chief part of his fortune. "With his lady," cried our friend in great agitation, for this story had frightened him extremely. "And, alas," replied the doctor, who regarded Wilhelm's exclamation only as the voice of common sympathy, "this lady is herself possessed with a deeper sorrow, which renders a removal from the world desirable to her also. The same young man was taking leave of her. She was not circumspect enough to hide a nascent inclination toward him. The youth grew bolder, clasped her in his arms, and pressed a large portrait of her husband, which was set with diamonds, forcibly against her breast. She felt a sharp pain, which gradually went off, leaving first a little redness, then no trace at all. As a man, I am convinced that she has nothing further to reproach herself with in this affair. As a physician, I am certain that this pressure could not have the smallest ill effect. Yet she will not be persuaded that an induration is not taking place in the part, and if you try to overcome her notion by the evidence of feeling, she maintains that, though the evil is away this moment, it will return the next. She conceives that the disease will end in cancer, and thus her youth and loveliness be altogether lost to others and herself." "Wretch that I am!" cried Wilhelm, striking his brow, and rushing from the company into the fields. He had never felt himself in such a miserable case. The clergyman and the physician were, of course, exceedingly astonished at this singular discovery. In the evening all their skill was called for, when our friend returned, and with a circumstantial disclosure of the whole occurrence, uttered the most violent accusations of himself. Both took interest in him, both felt a real concern about his general condition, particularly as he painted it in the gloomy colours which arose from the humour of the moment. Next day the physician, without much entreaty, was prevailed upon to accompany him in his return, both that he might bear him company, and that he might, if possible, do something for Aurelia, whom our friend had left in rather dangerous circumstances. In fact, they found her worse than they expected. She was afflicted with a sort of intermittent fever, which could the less be mastered as she purposely maintained and aggravated the attacks of it. The stranger was not introduced as a physician. He behaved with great courteousness and prudence. They conversed about her situation, bodily and mental. Her new friend related many anecdotes of persons who, in spite of lingering disorders, had attained a good old age, adding that, in such cases, nothing could be more injurious than the intentional recalling of passionate and disagreeable emotions. In particular, he stated that for persons labouring under chronic and partly incurable distempers, he had always found it a very happy circumstance when they chanced to entertain and cherish in their minds true feelings of religion. This he signified in the most unobtrusive manner, as it were historically, promising Aurelia at the same time the reading of a very interesting manuscript, which he said he had received from the hands of an excellent lady of his friends, who was now deceased. "To me," he said, "it is of uncommon value, and I shall trust you even with the original. Nothing but the title is in my handwriting. I have called it Confessions of a Fair Saint." Touching the medical and dietetic treatment of the racked and hapless patient, he also left his best advice with Wilhelm. He then departed, promising to write, and if possible to come again in person. Meanwhile, in Wilhelm's absence, there had changes been preparing such as he was not aware of. During his directorship our friend had managed all things with a certain liberality and freedom, looking chiefly at the main result. Whatever was required for dresses, decorations, and the like, he had usually provided in a plentiful and handsome style, and for securing the cooperation of his people he had flattered their self-interest, since he could not reach them by nobler motives. In this he felt his conduct justified the more, as Serlo, for his own part, never aimed at being a strict economist, but liked to hear the beauty of his theatre commended, and was contented if Aurelia, who conducted the domestic matters, on defraying all expenses, signified that she was free from debt, and could besides afford the necessary sums for clearing off such scores as Serlo in the interim, by lavish kindness to his mistresses or otherwise, might have incurred. Melina, who was charged with managing the wardrobe, had all the while been silently considering these things, with the cold, spiteful temper peculiar to him. On occasion of our friend's departure and Aurelia's increasing sickness, he contrived to signify to Serlo that more money might be raised and less expended, and consequently something be laid up, or at least a merrier life be led. Serlo hearkened gladly to such allegations, and Melina risked the exhibition of his plan. "I will not say," continued he, "that any of your actors has at present too much salary. They are meritorious people. They would find a welcome anywhere. But for the income which they bring us in, they have too much. My project would be to set up an opera. And as to what concerns the playhouse, I may be allowed to say it. You are the person for maintaining that establishment upon your single strength. Observe how at present your merits are neglected, and justice has refused you, not because your fellow actors are excellent, but merely good. Come out alone, as used to be the case. Endeavour to attract around you middling, I will even say inferior people, for a slender salary. Regale the public with mechanical displays, as you can so cleverly do. Apply your remaining means to the opera, which I am talking of, and you will quickly see that, with the same labour and expense, you will give greater satisfaction, while you draw incomparably more money than at present." These observations were so flattering to Serlo that they could not fail of making some impression on him. He readily admitted that, loving music as he did, he had long wished for some arrangement such as this, though he could not but perceive that the public taste would thus be still more widely led astray, and that with such a mongrel theatre, not properly an opera, not properly a playhouse, any residue of true feeling for regular and perfect works of art must shortly disappear. Melina ridiculed, in terms more plain than delicate, our friend's pedantic notions in this matter, and his vain attempts to form the public mind, instead of being formed by it. Serlo and he at last agreed, with full conviction, that the sole concern was how to gather money, and grow rich, or live a joyous life, and they scarcely concealed their wish to be delivered from those persons who at present hindered them. Melina took occasion to lament Aurelia's weak health, and the speedy end which it threatened, thinking all the while directly the reverse. Serlo affected to regret that Wilhelm could not sing, thus signifying that his presence was by no means indispensable. Melina then came forward with a whole catalogue of savings, which he said might be effected, and Serlo saw in him his brother-in-law replaced threefold. They both felt that secrecy was necessary in the matter, but this mutual obligation only joined them closer in their interests. They failed not to converse together privately on everything that happened, to blame whatever Wilhelm or Aurelia undertook, and to elaborate their own project, and prepare it more and more for execution. Silent as they both might be about their plan, little as their words betrayed them, in their conduct they were not so politic as constantly to hide their purposes. Melina now opposed our friend in many points that lay within the province of the latter, and Serlo, who had never acted smoothly to his sister, seemed to grow more bitter the more her sickness deepened, the more her passionate and variable humours would have needed toleration. About this period they took up the Emilie Galotti of Lessing. The parts were very happily distributed and filled. Within the narrow circle of this tragedy, the company found room for showing all the complex riches of their acting. Serlo, in the character of Marinelli, was altogether in his place. Odoardo was very well exhibited. Madame Melina played the mother with considerable skill. Elmira gained distinction as Emily. Laertes made a stately Appiani, and Wilhelm had bestowed the study of some months upon the prince's part. On this occasion, both internally and with Aurelia and Serlo, he had often come upon this question: what is the distinction between a noble and a well-bred manner? And how far must the former be included in the latter, though the latter is not in the former? Serlo, who himself in Marinelli had to act the courtier accurately, without caricature, afforded him some valuable thoughts on this. "A well-bred carriage," he would say, "is difficult to imitate, for in strictness it is negative, and it implies a long-continued previous training. You are not required to exhibit in your manner anything that specially betokens dignity, for by this means you are like to run into formality and haughtiness. You are rather to avoid whatever is undignified and vulgar. You are never to forget yourself, are to keep a constant watch upon yourself and others, to forgive nothing that is faulty in your own conduct, in that of others neither to forgive too little nor too much. Nothing must appear to touch you, nothing agitate. You must never overhaste yourself, must ever keep yourself composed, retaining still an outward calmness, whatever storms may rage within. The noble character at certain moments may resign himself to his emotions, the well-bred never. The latter is like a man dressed out in fair and spotless clothes. He will not lean on anything. Every person will beware of rubbing on him. He distinguishes himself from others, yet he may not stand apart. For as in all arts, so in this, the hardest must at length be done with ease. The well-bred man of rank, in spite of every separation, always seems united with the people round him. He is never to be stiff or uncomplying. He is always to appear the first, and never to insist on so appearing. It is clear, then, that to seem well-bred a man must actually be so. It is also clear why women generally are more expert at taking up the air of breeding than the other sex, why courtiers and soldiers catch it more easily than other men. Wilhelm now despaired of doing justice to his part, but Serlo aided and encouraged him, communicated the acutest observations on detached points, and furnished him so well that, on the exhibition of the piece, the public reckoned him a very proper prince. Serlo had engaged to give him, when the play was over, such remarks as might occur upon his acting. A disagreeable contention with Aurelia prevented any conversation of that kind. Aurelia had acted the character of Orsina in such a style as few have ever done. She was well acquainted with the part, and during the rehearsals she had treated it indifferently. But in the exhibition of the piece she had opened, as it were, all the sluices of her personal sorrow, and the character was represented so as never poet in the first glow of invention could have figured it. A boundless applause rewarded her painful efforts, but her friends, on visiting her when the play was finished, found her half fainting in her chair. Serlo had already signified his anger at her overcharged acting, as he called it. At this disclosure of her inmost heart before the public, to many individuals of which the history of her fatal passion was more or less completely known, he had spoken bitterly and fiercely, grinding with his teeth and stamping with his feet, as was his custom when enraged. "Never mind her," cried he, when he saw her in the chair, surrounded by the rest. "She will go upon the stage stark naked one of these days, and then the approbation will be perfect." "Ungrateful, inhuman man," exclaimed she, "soon shall I be carried naked to the place where approbation or disapprobation can no longer reach our ears." With these words she started up and hastened to the door. The maid had not yet brought her mantle. The sedan was not in waiting. It had been raining lately. A cold, raw wind was blowing through the streets. They endeavoured to persuade her to remain, for she was very warm. But in vain. She purposely walked slow. She praised the coolness, seemed to inhale it with peculiar eagerness. No sooner was she home than she became so hoarse that she could hardly speak a word. She did not mention that there was a total stiffness in her neck and along her back. Shortly afterward a sort of palsy in the tongue came on, so that she pronounced one word instead of another. They put her to bed. By numerous and copious remedies the evil changed its form, but was not mastered. The fever gathered strength. Her case was dangerous. Next morning she enjoyed a quiet hour. She sent for Wilhelm and delivered him a letter. "This sheet," said she, "has long been waiting for the present moment. I feel that my end is drawing nigh. Promise me that you yourself will take this paper, that by a word or two you will avenge my sorrows on the faithless man. He is not void of feeling. My death will pain him for a moment." Wilhelm took the letter, still endeavouring to console her and to drive away the thought of death. "No," said she, "do not deprive me of my nearest hope. I have waited for him long. I will joyfully clasp him when he comes." Shortly after this the manuscript arrived which the physician had engaged to send her. She called for Wilhelm, made him read it to her. The effect which it produced upon her the reader will be better able to appreciate after looking at the following book. The violent and stubborn temper of our poor Aurelia was mollified by hearing it. She took back the letter, and wrote another, as it seemed, in a meeker tone, charging Wilhelm at the same time to console her friend, if he should be distressed about her death, to assure him that she had forgiven him and wished him every kind of happiness. From this time she was very quiet and appeared to occupy herself with but a few ideas, which she endeavoured to extract and appropriate from the manuscript, out of which she frequently made Wilhelm read to her. The decay of her strength was not perceptible, nor had Wilhelm been anticipating the event when one morning, as he went to visit her, he found that she was dead. Entertaining such respect for her as he had done, and accustomed as he was to live in her society, the loss of her affected him with no common sorrow. She was the only person that had truly wished him well. The coldness of Serlo he had felt of late but too keenly. He hastened, therefore, to perform the service she had entrusted to him. He wished to be absent for a time. On the other hand, this journey was exceedingly convenient for Melina. In the course of his extensive correspondence, he had lately entered upon terms with a male and a female singer, who, it was intended, should, by their performances and interludes, prepare the public for his future opera. The loss of Aurelia and Wilhelm's absence were to be supplied in this manner, and our friend was satisfied with anything that could facilitate his setting out. He had formed within himself a singular idea of the importance of his errand. The death of his unhappy friend had moved him deeply, and having seen her pass so early from the scene, he could not but be hostilely inclined against the man who had abridged her life, and made that shortened term so full of woe. Notwithstanding the last mild words of the dying woman, he resolved that, on delivering his letter, he would pass a strict sentence on her faithless friend. And not wishing to depend upon the temper of the moment, he studied an address, which, in the course of preparation, became more pathetic than just. Having fully convinced himself of the good composition of his essay, he began committing it to memory, and at the same time making ready for departure. Mignon was present as he packed his articles. She asked him whether he intended travelling south or north, and learning that it was the latter, she replied, "Then I will wait here for thee." She begged of him the pearl necklace which had once been Mariana's. He could not refuse to gratify the dear little creature, and he gave it her, the neckerchief she had already. On the other hand, she put the veil of Hamlet's ghost into his travelling bag, though he told her it could not be of any service to him. Melina took upon him the directorship. His wife engaged to keep a mother's eye upon the children, whom Wilhelm parted with unwillingly. Felix was very merry at the setting out, and when asked what pretty thing he wished to have brought back to him, he said, "Hark you, bring me a papa." Mignon seized the traveller's hand, then standing on her tiptoes, she pressed a warm and cordial, though not a tender, kiss upon his lips, and cried, "Master, forget us not, and come soon back." And so we leave our friend entering on his journey amid a thousand different thoughts and feelings, and here subjoined by way of close a little poem which Mignon had recited once or twice with great expressiveness, and which the hurry of so many singular occurrences prevented us from inserting sooner. "Not speech, bid silence, I implore thee, for secrecy's my duty still. My heart entire I'd fain lay bare before thee, but such is not of fate the will. In season due the sun's course backward throws dark night, ensue must light, the mountain's hard rock at length its bosom doth unclose, now grudging earth no more the hidden fountains. Each seeks repose upon a friend's true breast, whereby laments he frees his bosom lonely, whereas an oath my lips hold closely pressed, the which to speech a god can open only." Editor's version. End of section 3. Section 4 of Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Volume 2, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, translated by Thomas Carlyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 6, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Confessions of a Fair Saint, Beginning. Till my 8th year I was always a healthy child, but of that period I can recollect no more than of the day when I was born. About the beginning of my 8th year I was seized with a hemorrhage, and from that moment my soul became all feeling, all memory. The smallest circumstances of that accident are yet before my eyes as if they had occurred but yesterday. During the 9 months which I then spent patiently upon a sick bed, it appears to me the groundwork of my whole turn of thought was laid, as the first means were then afforded my mind of developing itself in its own manner. I suffered and I loved. This was the peculiar form of my heart. In the most violent fits of coughing, in the depressing pains of fever, I lay quiet, like a snail drawn back within its house. The moment I obtained a respite, I wanted to enjoy something pleasant, and as every other pleasure was denied me, I endeavoured to amuse myself with the innocent delights of eye and ear. The people brought me dolls and picture-books, and whoever would sit by my bed was obliged to tell me something. From my mother I rejoiced to hear the Bible histories, and my father entertained me with natural curiosities. He had a very pretty cabinet, from which he brought me first one drawer and then another, as occasion served, showing me the articles and pointing out their properties. Dried plants and insects, with many kinds of anatomical preparations, such as human skins, bones, mummies, and the like, were in succession laid upon the sick bed of the little one. The birds and animals he killed in hunting were shown to me, before they passed into the kitchen. And that the prince of the world might also have a voice in this assembly, my aunt related to me love adventures out of fairy tales. All was accepted, all took root. There were hours in which I vividly conversed with the invisible power. I can still repeat some verses which I then dictated, and my mother wrote down. Often I would tell my father back again what I had learned from him. Rarely did I take any physic without asking where the simples it was made of grew, what look they had, what names they bore. Nor had the stories of my aunt lighted on stony ground. I figured myself out in pretty clothes, and met the most delightful princes, who could find no peace or rest till they discovered who the unknown beauty was. One adventure of this kind, with a charming little angel dressed in white, with golden wings, who warmly courted me, I dwelt upon so long that my imagination painted out his form almost to visibility. After a year I was pretty well restored to health, but nothing of the giddiness of childhood remained with me. I could not play with dolls. I longed for beings able to return my love. Dogs, cats, and birds, of which my father kept a great variety, afforded me delight. But what would I have given for such a creature as my aunt once told me of? It was a lamb which a peasant girl took up and nourished in a wood. But in the guise of this pretty beast an enchanted prince was hid, who at length appeared in his native shape, a lovely youth, and rewarded his benefactress by his hand. Such a lamb I would have given the world for. But there was none to be had, and as everything about me went on in such a quite natural manner, I by degrees all but abandoned nearly all hopes of such a treasure. Meanwhile I comforted myself by reading books in which the strangest incidents were set forth. Among them all my favourite was the Christian-German Hercules. That devout love history was altogether in my way. Whenever anything befell his dear Valiska, and cruel things befell her, he always prayed before hastening to her aid, and the prayers stood there verbatim. My longing after the invisible, which I had always dimly felt, was strengthened by such means, for in short it was ordained that God should also be my confidant. As I grew older I continued reading, heaven knows what, in chaotic order. The Roman Octavia was the book I liked beyond all others. The persecutions of the first Christians, decorated with the charms of a romance, awoke the deepest interest in me. But my mother now began to murmur at my constant reading, and, to humour her, my father took away my books today, but gave them back tomorrow. She was wise enough to see that nothing could be done in this way. She next insisted merely that my Bible should be read with equal diligence. To this I was not disinclined, and I accordingly perused the sacred volume with a lively interest. Withal, my mother was extremely careful that no books of a corruptive tendency should come into my hands. Immodest writings I would, of my own accord, have cast away, for my princes and my princesses were all extremely virtuous. To my mother and my zeal for knowledge it was owing that, with all my love of books, I also learned to cook, for much was to be seen in cookery. To cut up a hen, a pig, was quite a feast for me. I used to bring the entrails to my father, and he talked with me about them as if I had been a student of anatomy. With suppressed joy he would often call me his misfashioned son. I had passed my 12th year. I learned French, dancing, and drawing. I received the usual instructions in religion. In the latter many thoughts and feelings were awakened, but nothing properly relating to my own condition. I liked to hear the people speak of God. I was proud that I could speak on these points better than my equals. I zealously read many books which put me in a condition to talk about religion. But it never once struck me to think how matters stood with me, whether my soul was formed according to these holy precepts, whether it was like a glass from which the everlasting sun could be reflected in its glancing. From the first I had presupposed all this. My French I learned with eagerness. My teacher was a clever man. He was not a vain empiric, not a dry grammarian. He had learning, he had seen the world. Instructing me in language, he satisfied my zeal for knowledge in a thousand ways. I loved him so much that I used to wait his coming with a palpitating heart. Drawing was not hard for me. I should have made greater progress had my teacher possessed head and science. He had only hands and practice. Dancing was at first one of my smallest amusements. My body was too sensitive for it. I learned it only in the company of my sisters. But our dancing master took a thought of gathering all his scholars, male and female, and giving them a ball. This event gave dancing quite another charm for me. Amid a throng of boys and girls, the most remarkable were two sons of the marshal of the court. The youngest was of my age, the other 2 years older. They were children of such beauty that, according to the universal voice, no one had seen their like. For my part, scarcely had I noticed them when I lost sight of all the other crowd. From that moment I began to dance with care, and to wish that I could dance with grace. How came it, on the other hand, that these two boys distinguished me from all the rest? No matter. Before an hour had passed we had become the warmest friends, and our little entertainment did not end till we had fixed upon the time and place where we were next to meet. What a joy for me! And how charmed was I next morning when both of them inquired for my health, each in a gallant note, accompanied with a nosegay. I have never since felt as I then did. Compliment was met by compliment, letter answered letter. The church and the public walks were grown a rendezvous. Our young acquaintances in all their little parties now invited us together, while at the same time we were sly enough to veil the business from our parents, so that they saw no more of it than we thought good. Thus I had at once got a pair of lovers. I had yet decided upon neither. They both pleased me, and we did extremely well together. All at once the eldest of the two fell very sick. I myself had often been sick, and thus I was enabled, by rendering him many little dainties and delicacies suited for a sick person, to afford some solace to the sufferer. His parents thankfully acknowledged my attention. In compliance with the prayer of their beloved son, they invited me, with all my sisters, to their house so soon as he had arisen from his sickbed. The tenderness which he displayed on meeting me was not the feeling of a child. From that day I gave the preference to him. He warned me to keep our secret from his brother, but the flame could no longer be concealed, and the jealousy of the younger completed our romance. He played us 1,000 tricks. Eager to annihilate our joys, he but increased the passion he was seeking to destroy. At last I had actually found the wished-for lamb, and this attachment acted on me like my sickness. It made me calm, and drew me back from noisy pleasures. I was solitary, I was moved, and thoughts of God again occurred to me. He was again my confidant, and I well remember with what tears I often prayed for this poor boy, who still continued sickly. The more childishness there was in this adventure, the more did it contribute to the forming of my heart. Our French teacher had now turned us from translating into daily writing him some letter of our own invention. I brought my little history to market, shrouded in the names of Phyllis and Damon. The old man soon saw through it, and, to render me communicative, praised my labour very much. I still waxed bolder, came openly out with the affair, adhering, even in the minute details, to truth. I do not now remember what the passage was at which he took occasion to remark, "How pretty, how natural it is! But the good Phyllis had better have a care. The thing may soon grow serious." I felt vexed that he did not look upon the matter as already serious, and I asked him with an air of pique what he meant by serious. I had not to repeat the question. He explained himself so clearly that I could scarcely hide my terror. Yet as anger came along with it, as I took it ill that he should entertain such thoughts, I kept myself composed. I tried to justify my nymph, and said with glowing cheeks, "But, sir, Phyllis is an honourable girl." He was rogue enough to banter me about my honourable heroine. While we were speaking French, he played upon the word honnête, and hunted the honourableness of Phyllis over all its meanings. I felt the ridicule of this, and extremely puzzled. He, not to frighten me, broke off, but afterward often led the conversation to such topics. Plays and little histories, such as I was reading and translating with him, gave him frequent opportunity to show how feeble a security against the calls of inclination our boasted virtue was. I no longer contradicted him, but I was in secret scandalized, and his remarks became a burden to me. With my worthy Damon, too, I by degrees fell out of all connection. The chicanery of the younger boy destroyed our intercourse. Soon after, both these blooming creatures died. I lamented sore. However, in a short time I forgot. But Phyllis rapidly increased in stature, was altogether healthy, and began to see the world. The hereditary prince now married, and a short time after, on his father's death, began his rule. Court and town were in the liveliest motion. My curiosity had copious nourishment. There were plays and balls, with all their usual accompaniments, and though my parents kept retired as much as possible, they were obliged to show themselves at court, where I was of course introduced. Strangers were pouring in from every side. High company was in every house. Even to us some cavaliers were recommended, others introduced, and at my uncle's men of every nation might be met with. My honest mentor still continued in a modest and yet striking way to warn me, and I in secret to take it ill of him. With regard to his assertion that women under every circumstance were weak, I did not feel at all convinced, and here perhaps I was in the right, and my mentor in the wrong. But he spoke so earnestly that once I grew afraid he might be right, and said to him with much vivacity, "Since the danger is so great, and the human heart so weak, I will pray to God that he may keep me." This simple answer seemed to please him, for he praised my purpose. But on my side it was anything but seriously meant. It was in truth but an empty word, for my feelings toward the invisible were almost totally extinguished. The hurry and the crowd I lived in dissipated my attention, and carried me along as in a rapid stream. These were the emptiest years of my life. All day long to speak of nothing, to have no solid thought, never to do anything but revel, such was my employment. On my beloved books I never once bestowed a thought. The people I lived among had not the slightest tinge of literature or science. They were German courtiers, a class of men at that time altogether destitute of culture. Such society, it may be thought, must naturally have led me to the brink of ruin. I lived away in mere corporeal cheerfulness. I never took myself to task, I never prayed, I never thought about myself or God. Yet I look upon it as a providential guidance that none of these many handsome, rich, and well-dressed men could take my fancy. They were rakes, and did not conceal it. This scared me back. They adorned their speech with double meanings. This offended me, made me act with coldness toward them. Many times their improprieties exceeded belief, and I did not restrain myself from being rude. Besides, my ancient counsellor had once in confidence contrived to tell me that, with the greater part of these lewd fellows, health, as well as virtue, was in danger. I now shuddered at the sight of them. I was afraid if one of them in any way approached too near me. I would not touch their cups or glasses, even the chairs they had been sitting on. Thus, morally and physically, I remained apart from them. All the compliments they paid me I haughtily accepted, as incense that was due. Among the strangers then resident among us was one young man particularly distinguished, whom we used in sport to call Narcisse. He had gained a reputation in the diplomatic line, and among the various changes now occurring at court, he was in hopes of meeting with some advantageous place. He soon became acquainted with my father. His acquirements and manners opened for him the way to a select society of most accomplished men. My father often spoke in praise of him. His figure, which was very handsome, would have made a still better impression had it not been for something of self-complacency which breathed from the whole carriage of the man. I had seen him, I thought well of him, but we had never spoken. At a great ball where we chanced to be in company, I danced a minuet with him, but this too passed without results. The more violent dances, in compliance with my father, who felt anxious about my health, I was accustomed to avoid. In the present case, when these came on, I retired to an adjoining room and began to talk with certain of my friends, elderly ladies, who had set themselves to cards. Narcisse, who had jigged it for a while, at last came into the room where I was, and having got the better of a bleeding at the nose, which had overtaken him in dancing, he began speaking with me about a multitude of things. In half an hour the talk had grown so interesting that neither of us could think of dancing any more. We were rallied by our friends, but we did not let their bantering disturb us. Next evening we recommenced our conversation and were very careful not to hurt our health. The acquaintance then was made. Narcisse was often with my sisters and myself, and I now once more began to reckon over and consider what I knew, what I thought of, what I had felt, and what I could express myself about in conversation. My new friend had mingled in the best society. Besides the department of history and politics, with every part of which he was familiar, he had gained extensive literary knowledge. There was nothing new that issued from the press, especially in France, that he was unacquainted with. He brought or sent me many a pleasant book, but this we had to keep as secret as forbidden love. Learned women had been made ridiculous, nor were well-informed women tolerated, apparently because it would have been uncivil to put so many ill-informed men to shame. Even my father, much as he delighted in this new opportunity of cultivating my mind, expressly stipulated that our literary commerce should remain secret. Thus our intercourse continued for almost year and day. And still I could not say that in any wise Narcisse had ever shown me aught of love or tenderness. He was always complaisant and kind, but manifested nothing like attachment. On the contrary, he even seemed to be in some degree affected by the charms of my youngest sister, who was then extremely beautiful. In sport he gave her many little friendly names out of foreign tongues, for he could speak two or three of these extremely well, and loved to mix their idiomatic phrases with his German. Such compliments she did not answer very liberally. She was entangled in a different noose, and being very sharp, while he was very sensitive, the two were often quarrelling about trifles. With my mother and my aunt he kept on very pleasant terms, and thus by gradual advances he was grown to be a member of the family. Who knows how long we might have lived in this way, had not a curious accident altered our relations all at once. My sisters and I were invited to a certain house, to which we did not like to go. The company was too mixed, and persons of the stupidest, if not the rudest, stamp were often to be met there. Narcisse on this occasion was invited also, and on his account I felt inclined to go, for I was sure of finding one, at least, whom I could converse with as I desired. Even at table we had many things to suffer, for several of the gentlemen had drunk too much. Then in the drawing-room they insisted on a game at forfeits. It went on with great vivacity and tumult. Narcisse had lost a forfeit. They ordered him, by way of penalty, to whisper something pleasant in the ear of every member of the company. It seems he stayed too long beside my next neighbour, the lady of a captain. The latter on a sudden struck him such a box with his fist that the powder flew about me, into my eyes. When I had got my eyes cleared and in some degree recovered from my terror, I saw that both gentlemen had drawn their swords. Narcisse was bleeding, and the other, mad with wine and rage and jealousy, could scarcely be held back by all the company. I seized Narcisse, led him by the arm upstairs, and as I did not think my friend safe even here from his frantic enemy, I shut the door and bolted it. Neither of us considered the wound serious, for a slight cut across the hand was all we saw. Soon, however, I discovered that there was a stream of blood running down his back, that there was a deep wound on the head. I now began to be afraid. I hastened to the lobby to get help, but I could see no person. Everyone had stayed below to calm the raving captain. At last a daughter of the family came skipping up. Her mirth annoyed me. She was like to die with laughing at the bedlam spectacle. I conjured her, for the sake of heaven, to get a surgeon, and she, in her wild way, sprang downstairs to fetch me one herself. Returning to my wounded friend, I bound my handkerchief about his hand and a neckerchief that was hanging on the door about his head. He was still bleeding copiously. He now grew pale and seemed as if he were about to faint. There was none at hand to aid me. I very freely put my arm round him, patted his cheek, and tried to cheer him by little flatteries. It seemed to act on him like a spiritual remedy. He kept his senses but sat as pale as death. At last the active housewife arrived. It is easy to conceive her terror when she saw my friend in this predicament, lying in my arms, and both of us bestreamed with blood. No one had supposed he was wounded. All imagined I had carried him away in safety. Now smelling bottles, wine, and everything that could support and stimulate were copiously produced. The surgeon also came, and I might easily have been dispensed with. Narcisse, however, held me firmly by the hand. I would have stayed without holding. During the dressing of his wounds I continued wetting his lips with wine. I minded not, though all the company were now about us. The surgeon having finished, his patient took a mute but tender leave of me, and was conducted home. The mistress of the house now led me to her bedroom. She had to strip me altogether, and I must confess, while they washed the blood from me, I saw with pleasure for the first time in a mirror that I might be reckoned beautiful without help of dress. No portion of my clothes could be put on again, and as the people of the house were all either less or larger than myself, I was taken home in a strange disguise. My parents were, of course, astonished. They felt exceedingly indignant at my fright, at the wounds of their friend, at the captain's madness, at the whole occurrence. A very little would have made my father send the captain a challenge, that he might avenge his friend without delay. He blamed the gentlemen that had been there, because they had not punished on the spot such a murderous attempt. For it was but too clear that the captain, instantly on striking, had drawn his sword and wounded the other from behind. The cut across the hand had been given just when Narcisse himself was grasping at his sword. I felt unspeakably affected, altered, or how shall I express it? The passion which was sleeping at the deepest bottom of my heart had at once broken loose, like a flame getting air. and if joy and pleasure are well suited for the first producing and the silent nourishing of love, yet this passion, bold by nature, is most easily impelled by terror to decide and to declare itself. My mother gave her little flurried daughter some medicine, and made her go to bed. With the earliest morrow my father hastened to Narcisse, whom he found lying very sick of a wound fever. He told me little of what passed between them, but tried to quiet me about the probable results of this event. They were now considering whether an apology should be accepted, whether the affair should go before a court of justice, and many other points of that description. I knew my father too well to doubt that he would be averse to see the matter end without a duel, but I held my peace, for I had learned from him before that women should not meddle in such things. For the rest, it did not strike me as if anything had passed between the friends in which my interests were specially concerned. But my father soon communicated to my mother the purport of their further conversation. Narcisse, he said, appeared to be exceedingly affected at the help afforded by me, had embraced him, declared himself my debtor for ever, signified that he desired no happiness except what he could share with me, and concluded by entreating that he might presume to ask my hand. All this mamma repeated to me, but subjoined the safe reflection that, as for what was said in the first agitation of mind in such a case, there was little trust to be placed in it. Of course, none, I answered with affected coldness, though all the while I was feeling heaven knows what. Narcisse continued sick for 2 months. Owing to the wound in his right hand, he could not even write. Yet in the meantime he showed me his regard by the most obliging courtesies. All these unusual attentions I combined with what my mother had disclosed to me, and constantly my head was full of fancies. The whole city talked of the occurrence. With me they spoke of it in a peculiar tone. They drew inferences which, greatly as I struggled to avoid them, touched me very close. What had formerly been habitude and trifling was now grown seriousness and inclination. The anxiety in which I lived was the more violent, the more carefully I studied to conceal it from everyone. The idea of losing him frightened me. The possibility of any closer union made me tremble. For a half-prudent girl, there is really something awful in the thought of marriage. By such incessant agitations I was once more led to recollect myself. The gaudy imagery of a thoughtless life, which used to hover day and night before my eyes, was at once blown away. My soul again began to awaken, but the greatly interrupted intimacy with my invisible friend was not so easy to renew. We still continued at a frigid distance. It was again something, but little to the times of old. A duel had been fought, and the captain severely wounded, before I ever heard of it. The public feeling was, in all senses, strong on the side of my lover, who at length again appeared upon the scene. But, first of all, he came, with his head tied up and his arm in a sling, to visit us. How my heart beat while he was there! The whole family was present. General thanks and compliments were all that passed on either side. Narcisse, however, found an opportunity to show some secret tokens of his love to me, by which means my inquietude was but increased. After his recovery he visited us throughout the winter on the former footing, and in spite of all the soft, private marks of tenderness which he contrived to give me, the whole affair remained unsettled, undiscussed. In this manner was I kept in constant practice. I could trust my thoughts to no mortal, and from God I was too far removed. Him I had quite forgotten those 4 wild years. I now again began to think of him occasionally, but our acquaintance had grown cool. There were visits of mere ceremony, these, and as, moreover, in waiting on him, I used to dress in fine apparel, to set before him self-complacently my virtue, honour, and superiorities to others, he did not seem to notice me, or know me in that finery. A courtier would have been exceedingly distressed if the prince who held his fortune in his hands had treated him in this way. But for me, I did not sorrow at it. I had what I required, health and conveniences. If God should please to think of me, well. If not, I reckoned I had done my duty. This, in truth, I did not think at that period, yet it was the true figure of my soul. But to change and purify my feelings, preparations were already made. The spring came on. Narcisse once visited me unannounced, and at a time when I happened to be quite alone. He appeared in the character of lover, and asked me if I could bestow on him my heart, and, so soon as he should obtain some lucrative and honourable place, my hand along with it. He had been received into our service, but at first they kept him back, and would not rapidly promote him, because they dreaded his ambition. Having some little fortune of his own, he was left with a slender salary. Notwithstanding my regard for him, I knew that he was not a man to treat with altogether frankly. I drew up, therefore, and referred him to my father. About my father he did not seem to doubt, but wished first to be at one with me, now and here. I at last said yes, but stipulated as an indispensable condition that my parents should concur. He then spoke formally with both of them. They signified their satisfaction. Mutual promises were given, on the faith of his advancement, which it was expected would be speedy. Sisters and aunts were informed of this arrangement, and the strictest secrecy enjoined on them. Thus had my lover become my bridegroom, and great was the difference between the two. If one could change the lovers of all honourable maidens into bridegrooms, it would be a kindness to our sex, even though marriage should not follow the connection. The love between two persons does not lessen by the change, but it becomes more reasonable. Innumerable little follies, all coquetries and caprices, disappear. If the bridegroom tells us that we please him better in a morning cap than in the finest headdress, no discreet young woman will disturb herself about her hairdressing. And nothing is more natural than that he, too, should think solidly and rather wish to form a housewife for himself than a gaudy doll for others. And thus it is in every province of the business. Should a young woman of this kind be fortunate enough to have a bridegroom who possesses understanding and acquirements, she learns from him more than universities and foreign lands can teach. She not only willingly receives instruction when he offers it, but she endeavours to elicit more and more from him. Love makes much that was impossible possible. By degrees, too, that subjection, so necessary and so graceful for the female sex, begins. The bridegroom does not govern like the husband. He only asks. But his mistress seeks to discover what he wants, and to offer it before he asks it. So did experience teach me what I would not for much have missed. I was happy, truly happy as woman could be in the world, that is to say, for a while. Amid these quiet joys, a summer passed away. Narcisse gave not the slightest reason to complain of him. He daily became more dear to me. My whole soul was his. This he well knew, and knew also how to prize it. Meanwhile, from seeming trifles, something rose, which by and by grew hurtful to our union. Narcisse behaved to me as to a bride, and never dared to ask of me such favours as were yet forbidden us. But about the boundaries of virtue and decorum, we were of very different opinions. I meant to walk securely, and so never granted him the smallest freedom which the whole world might not have witnessed. He, used to dainties, thought this diet very strict. On this point there was continual variance. He praised my modesty, and sought to undermine my resolution. The serious of my old French teacher now occurred to me, as well as the defence which I had once suggested in regard to it. With God I had again become a little more acquainted. He had given me a bridegroom whom I loved, and for this I felt some thankfulness. Earthly love itself concentrated my soul, and put its powers in motion. Nor did it contradict my intercourse with God. I naturally complained to him of what alarmed me, but I did not perceive that I myself was wishing and desiring it. In my own eyes I was strong. I did not pray, lead us not into temptation. My thoughts were far beyond temptation. In this flimsy tinsel work of virtue I came to God. He did not drive me back. On the smallest movement toward him, he left a soft impression in my soul, and this impression caused me always to return. Except Narcisse, the world was altogether dead to me. Excepting him, there was nothing in it that had any charm. Even my love for dress was but the wish to please him. If I knew that he was not to see me, I could spend no care upon it. I liked to dance, but if he was not beside me, it seemed as if I could not bear the motion. At a brilliant festival, if he was not invited, I could neither take the trouble of providing new things, nor of putting on the old according to the mode. To me they were alike agreeable, or rather I might say alike burdensome. I used to reckon such an evening very fairly spent when I could join myself to any ancient card-party, though formerly I had not the smallest taste for such things. And if some old acquaintance came and rallied me about it, I would smile, perhaps for the first time all that night. So likewise it was with promenades and every social entertainment that can be imagined. Him had I chosen from all others. His would I be, and not another's. To me his love was all in all. Thus was I often solitary in the midst of company, and real solitude was generally acceptable to me. But my busy soul could neither sleep nor dream. I felt and thought and acquired by degrees some faculty to speak about my feelings and my thoughts with God. Then were feelings of another sort unfolded, but these did not contradict the former feelings. My affection to Narcisse accorded with the universal scheme of nature. It nowhere hindered the performance of a duty. They did not contradict each other, yet they were immensely different. Narcisse was the only living form which hovered in my mind, and to which my love was all directed. But the other feeling was not directed toward any form, and yet it was unspeakably agreeable. I no longer have it. I no longer can impart it. My lover, whom I used to trust with all my secrets, did not know of this. I soon discovered that he thought far otherwise. He often gave me writings which opposed, with light and heavy weapons, all that can be called connection with the invisible. I used to read the books because they came from him, but at the end I knew no word of all that had been argued in them. Nor, in regard to sciences and knowledge, was there want of contradiction in our conduct. He did as all men do. He mocked at learned women, and yet he kept continually instructing me. He used to speak with me on all subjects, law excepted, and while constantly procuring books of every kind for me, he frequently repeated the uncertain precept that a lady ought to keep the knowledge she might have more secret than the Calvinists his creed in Catholic countries. And while I, by natural consequence, endeavoured not to show myself more wise or learned than formerly before the world, Narcisse himself was commonly the first who yielded to the vanity of speaking about me and my superiorities. A nobleman of high repute, and at that time valued for his influence, his talents and accomplishments, was living at our court with great applause. He bestowed a special notice on Narcisse, whom he kept continually about him. They once had an argument about the virtue of women. Narcisse repeated to me what had passed between them. I was not wanting with my observations, and my friend required of me a written essay on the subject. I could write French fluently enough. I had laid a good foundation with my teacher. My correspondence with Narcisse was likewise carried out in French. Except in French books, there was then no elegant instruction to be had. My essay pleased the Count. I was obliged to let him have some little songs which I had lately been composing. In short, Narcisse appeared to revel without stint in the renown of his beloved, and the story, to his great contentment, ended with a French epistle in heroic verse, which the Count transmitted to him on departing, in which their argument was mentioned, and my friend reminded of his happiness in being destined, after all his doubts and errors, to learn most certainly what virtue was, in the arms of a virtuous and charming wife. He showed this poem first of all to me, and then to almost everyone, each thinking of the matter what he pleased. Thus did he act in several cases. Every stranger whom he valued must be made acquainted in our house. A noble family was staying for a season in the place, to profit by the skill of our physician. In this house, too, Narcisse was looked on as a son. He introduced me there. We found among these worthy persons the most pleasant entertainment for mind and heart. Even the common pastimes of society appeared less empty here than elsewhere. All knew how matters stood with us. They treated us as circumstances would allow, and left the main relation unalluded to. I mention this one family, because in the after period of my life it had a powerful influence upon me. Almost a year of our connection had elapsed, and along with it our spring was over. The summer came, and all grew drier and more earnest. By several unexpected deaths, some offices fell vacant, which Narcisse might make pretensions to. The instant was at hand when my whole destiny must be decided, and while Narcisse and all our friends were making every effort to efface some impressions which obstructed him at court, and to obtain for him the wished-for situation, I turned with my request to my invisible friend. I was received so kindly that I gladly came again. I confessed without disguise my wish that Narcisse might obtain the place, but my prayer was not importunate, and I did not require that it should happen for the sake of my petition. The place was obtained by a far inferior competitor. I was dreadfully troubled at this news. I hastened to my room, the door of which I locked behind me. The first fit of grief went off in a shower of tears. The next thought was, yet it was not by chance that it happened, and instantly I formed the resolution to be well content with it, seeing even this apparent evil would be for my true advantage. The softest emotions then pressed in upon me, and divided all the clouds of sorrow. I felt that, with help like this, there was nothing one might not endure. At dinner I appeared quite cheerful, to the great astonishment of all the house. Narcisse had less internal force than I, and I was called upon to comfort him. In his family, too, he had many crosses to encounter, some of which afflicted him considerably. And such true confidence subsisting between us, he entrusted me with all. His negotiations for entering on foreign service were not more fortunate. All this I felt deeply on his account and mine. All this, too, I ultimately carried to the place where my petitions had already been so well received. The softer these experiences were, the oftener did I endeavour to renew them. I hoped continually to meet with comfort where I had so often met with it. Yet I did not always meet with it. I was as one that goes to warm him in the sunshine, while there is something standing in the way that makes a shadow. What is this? I asked myself. I traced the matter zealously, and soon perceived that it all depended on the situation of my soul. If this was not turned in the straightest direction toward God, I still continued cold. I did not feel his counter-influence. I could obtain no answer. The second question was, what hinders this direction? Here I was in a wide field. I perplexed myself in an inquiry which lasted nearly all the second year of my attachment to Narcisse. I might have ended the investigation sooner, for it was not long till I had got upon the proper trace. But I would not confess it, and I sought a thousand outlets. I very soon discovered that the straight direction of my soul was marred by foolish dissipations and employment with unworthy things. The how and the where were clear enough to me, yet by what means could I help myself or extricate my mind from the calls of a world where everything was either cold indifference or hot insanity? Gladly would I have left things standing as they were, and lived from day to day, floating down with the stream like other people whom I saw quite happy. But I durst not. My inmost feelings contradicted me too often. Yet if I determined to renounce society and alter my relations to others, it was not in my power. I was hemmed in as by a ring drawn around me. Certain connections I could not dissolve, and in the matter which lay nearest to my heart, fatalities accumulated and oppressed me more and more. I often went to bed with tears, and after a sleepless night arose again with tears. I required some strong support, and God would not vouchsafe it me while I was running with the cap and bells. I proceeded now to estimate my doings, all and each. Dancing and play were first put upon their trial. Never was there anything spoken, thought, or written for or against these practices, which I did not examine, talk of, read, weigh, reject, aggravate, and plague myself about. If I gave up these habits, I was certain that Narcisse would be offended, for he dreaded exceedingly the ridicule which any look of straight-laced conscientiousness gives one in the eyes of the world. And doing what I now looked upon as folly, noxious folly, out of no taste of my own, but merely to gratify him, it all grew woefully irksome to me. Without disagreeable prolixities and repetitions, it is not in my power to represent what pains I took in trying so to counteract those occupations which distracted my attention and disturbed my peace of mind, that my heart, in spite of them, might still be open to the influences of the invisible being. But at last, with pain, I was compelled to admit that in this way the quarrel could not be composed. For no sooner had I clothed myself in the garment of folly than it came to be something more than a mask, than the foolishness pierced and penetrated me through and through. May I here overstep the province of a mere historical detail and offer one or two remarks on what was then taking place within me? What could it be which so changed my tastes and feelings that in my 22nd year, nay earlier, I lost all relish for the recreations with which people of that age are harmlessly delighted? Why were they not harmless for me? I may answer, just because they were not harmless, because I was not, like others of my years, unacquainted with my soul. No, I knew, from experiences which had reached me unsought, that there are loftier emotions, which afford us a contentment such as it is vain to seek in the amusements of the world, and that in these higher joys there is also kept a secret treasure for strengthening the spirit in misfortune. But the pleasures of society, the dissipations of youth, must needs have had a powerful charm for me, since it was not in my power to engage in them without participation, to act among them as if they were not there. How many things could I now do, if I liked, with entire coldness, which then dazzled and confounded me, nay, threatened to obtain the mastery over me? Here there could no medium be observed. Either those delicious amusements, or my nourishing and quickening internal emotions, must be given up. But in my soul the strife had, without my own consciousness, already been decided. Even if there still was anything within me that longed for earthly pleasures, I had now become unfitted for enjoying them. Much as a man might hanker after wine, all desire of drinking would forsake him if he should be placed among full barrels in a cellar where the foul air was like to suffocate him. Free air is more than wine. This I felt but too keenly. And from the first it would have cost me little studying to prefer the good to the delightful, if the fear of losing the affection of Narcisse had not restrained me. But at last, when after many thousand struggles and thoughts continually renewed, I began to cast a steady eye upon the bond which held me to him, I discovered that it was but weak, that it might be torn asunder. I at once perceived it to be only as a glass bell, which shut me up in the exhausted airless space. One bold stroke to break the bell in pieces, and thou art delivered. No sooner thought than tried. I drew off the mask, and on all occasions acted as my heart directed. Narcisse I still cordially loved, but the thermometer, which formerly had stood in hot water, was now hanging in the natural air. It could rise no higher than the warmth of the atmosphere directed. Unhappily it cooled very much. Narcisse drew back and began to assume a distant air. This was at his option, but my thermometer descended as he drew back. Our family observed this, questioned me, and seemed to be surprised. I explained to them with stout defiance that heretofore I had made abundant sacrifices, that I was ready, still further and to the end of my life, to share all crosses that befell him, but that I required full freedom in my conduct, that my doings and avoidings must depend upon my own conviction, that indeed I would never bigotedly cleave to my own opinion, but on the other hand would willingly be reasoned with. Yet as it concerned my own happiness, the decision must proceed from myself, and be liable to no manner of constraint. The greatest physician could not move me, by his reasonings, to take an article of food, which perhaps was altogether wholesome and agreeable to many, so soon as my experience had shown that on all occasions it was noxious to me. As I might produce coffee, for an instance, and just as little, nay, still less, would I have any sort of conduct which misled me, preached up and demonstrated upon me as morally profitable. End of section 4.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.